I have found out beat news in depth for you.
And good evening and welcome everyone to Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Moralia. Tonight we begin with a disturbing story about a relatively new crime problem here in the North Bay that you're likely totally unaware of. Human trafficking. Who would have ever thought that runaway kids from Santa Rosa would become involved in complex prostitution rings that are connected with cities like Oakland and San Francisco? Well, tonight, Detective Chris Mehurin from the Santa Rosa Police Department is here to tell us more about this disturbing problem. And in tonight's Outbeat Youth segment, we'll talk with Samantha Logan, a young trans woman and blogger for the Matthew Shepard Foundation. She'll share her own story and we'll talk about the contributions she's making to MatthewsPlace.com. All of this is coming up right after your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, April 28th, 2013.
I have found Outbeat Radio news, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
It was 60 years ago this past Friday on April 27, 1953, that President Eisenhower signed an executive order demanding all gay and lesbian government employees be fired. Josh Howard, an Emmy-winning producer from 60 Minutes and CNBC, read about this story in a book written by Dr. David John called The Lavender Scare. And now Howard is producing a documentary about this dark time in LGBT history.
We have your friend in the next room. She's already told us that you're gay. You give us the names of others and we'll go easier on you.
Committee, will please come to order.
Homosexuals must not be handling top secret material. The pervert is easy prey to the blackmailer.
It started this Lavender Scare. It started this systematic campaign to identify and remove all suspected gay men and lesbians from the federal civil service.
It was the most wonderful country in the world, and you should serve it. And then I found out they didn't want me.
I was called to the FBI office.
They wouldn't allow legal representation.
I was a scared kid.
They wouldn't reveal the evidence.
They said, we have information, you are homosexual. Do you have any comment?
And they would threaten exposure.
I submitted my resignation.
I lost my job at the patent office.
That was the end of it, I was out.
The people that I got rid of, they were faggots. I didn't give a hoot. Put them on a bread line.
Culturally, we were sick. Sinners, sexual perverts.
We were worse than communists. We knew that.
He was afraid he was under investigation. For his homosexuality. He was just not able to cope.
And they said, well, he committed suicide. My mom, she was out there crying her heart out. How do you deal with that?
I was the first person to fight back out of all of those large, huge number of people that were fired in the 50s.
And in 1965, he led a protest outside the White House, which was both an act of conscience, but also an act of extraordinary courage.
He has had more impact on moving forward gay civil rights than any other single individual.
I mean, it's a heartache that you have the rest of your days.
All of this needs to be said. People need to know.
Producer Josh Howard will be joining us next month on Outbeat News in Depth to tell us more about this documentary. You can learn more in the meantime at www.thelavenderscare.com. And in Washington State this week, Governor Jay Inslee signed a bill that will change the state's statutes dating back to 1854 to gender-neutral descriptions. Terms like firemen have already been changed to firefighters, but the new law will go further, adjusting words like ombudsman to ombuds and watchman to security guards. Now here's your calendar of events for the coming week. On Monday, April 29th, and every Monday at 5:30 p.m., the Petaluma Health Center hosts an LGBTQ support group at 1179 North McDowell Boulevard in Petaluma. And also on Monday at 7 p.m., the Parents of Transgender Youth Support Group will meet at Positive Images, 312 Chin Street in Santa Rosa. On Thursday, May 2nd, from 7 to 9 p.m., the Men for Men support group will gather at the Marin AIDS Project, 910 Irwin Street in San Rafael. And on Saturday, May 4th at 7 p.m., the Russian River Sisters will host the Closet Ball at the R3 Hotel and Resort in Guerneville. Men and women are assisted by sisters to transform and perform. The Wild event benefits the Sisters Scholarship Fund and the River to Coast Children's Services. Tickets are $10, and you can learn more at www.rrsisters.com. If you have news and event you'd like to share with our listeners, be sure to tell us about it by going to our own website at outbeatnews.com. And follow us all week long on Facebook and Twitter for the latest LGBT news and information from here in the North Bay and beyond. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia.
Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
Well, our first guest tonight is a good friend who's doing some seriously important work combating a crime problem that's threatening children here in the North Bay. Human trafficking is a relatively new problem for law enforcement and one I never imagined would even be present here in Santa Rosa. But even more disturbing is that the kind of human trafficking we're talking about involves the prostituting of children and a network that's organized and connected throughout the greater Bay Area. And here to tell us more about this problem is Santa Rosa Police Detective Chris Mahurin. Chris, welcome to Outbeat Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So start out by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got into law enforcement.
So I've been in law enforcement for just about 7 years now. It is something I've wanted to do since I was a young child. My goal in the world was to change the world and do anything I could to do that. I got started while I was working at a credit union prior to doing this and started meeting some police officers, and they took me on ride-alongs in Marin County, and I started to get the interest for it. Came up to Santa Rosa and was hired in 2006, and they put me through the police academy up in Windsor. From there, I went through the training program and began to hit the streets and start to see what was out there.
Fantastic. And you and I have known each other a long time, and we were talking earlier tonight about, it was 7 years ago?
Yes.
It seems like it was yesterday. Well, now that you're a detective with Santa Rosa PD, tell us about some of the cases and some of the types of crimes that you're responsible for investigating.
So currently I'm assigned to the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Unit of the Santa Rosa Police Department. I have a collateral assignment that focuses on child exploitation as well as human trafficking. Prior to becoming a detective, one of my fields of interest was actually prostitution and pimping in particular. I worked beats that focused primarily on Santa Rosa Avenue, which is a common area known as a track, that a lot of these women will walk up and down every night. And on patrol, I'd contact a lot of these women on a regular basis, and it was just the basic, what are you doing out here? They'd usually give you some story about visiting a friend or whatnot, and ultimately it would come down to, okay, this is why I'm here, this is what I'm doing, and this is what I'm earning. And you'd ask the questions, are you being trafficked? Do you have a pimp? And every time the girl would say no, whether she was 15 years old or 25 years old. And when you're on patrol, it's real difficult to go in depth because there's another call always pending, waiting to go to. So many times these women would just receive tickets, or they would receive, they go to jail, or just a warning and they take mm-hmm. off. Well, when I switched to this assignment about a year and a half ago, I decided that there had to be something more into this. So I started to look deeper into what was going on and realizing that the majority of these women that are working these tracks are forced out there. And so that's where kind of some of my exploration into this concept went into. And I'd start focusing primarily on that and reading reports that patrol officers would take and figuring out what more was going on behind there.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get into talking about the human trafficking and what that's all about, talk a little bit about some of the specialized training that you went through to investigate sex crimes.
Initially, when I got started, it's the basic kind of courses that we do for law enforcement. From there, because of my special assignment, I've been to trainings about sexual assault, victim trainings, homicide trainings, as well as child abuse and sexual assault for adults as well as minors. I've gone to numerous human trafficking training courses as well. Last November, I was flown out and recognized by Shared Hope International, who flew me out to Washington, D.C. to attend a conference on domestic minor sex trafficking. It focused primarily on the domestic aspect of what was going on in our own country, as opposed to people being brought over here from other countries.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we met for coffee, a couple months ago, and you were talking about what you were doing in your career, and you talked about human trafficking, the first thing that came to my mind was, immigrants being smuggled into the country and then being enslaved into labor, being forced into labor. It never even occurred to me that we would have a problem here in this county with children. start out by telling us what exactly is human trafficking? What's the definition of it?
Human trafficking is any individual that is forced into labor or sexual trafficking by force, fraud, or coercion. If they're an adult, one of those three elements has to be made, where the trafficker is receiving some sort of value, whether it's money or other valuable goods. When it comes to minors in particular, we don't actually have to prove force, fraud, or coercion, just with adults. So that's the basic definition of that.
And so the problem that you're working now in here in Santa Rosa in the North Bay involves children. Talk more about the scope of that. I mean, are they being forced into labor, or are they being forced into prostitution?
I think there's both aspects exist. I primarily focus on the sex trafficking portion of it in particular. We see a large age range that goes into this. You get forced into it. Primarily nationwide, we know that children get involved in the age of 12 to 14 years old is the entry age for many people that are forced into domestic minor sex trafficking.
12 years old?
Yeah. So, and that's just the average. So if you figure average is 12 to 14 years old, you're going to get 9, 10, 11-year-olds in that grouping to make up that average just to get there. There's also statistics that show that any juvenile that's run away more than four times in roughly a year to two-year period is about 50% more likely to already be involved in human trafficking. We find large numbers of the LGBT community that are also forced into this because many of them, of the street kids that are out there that are running away, are already homeless and have no way of earning income.
Right.
When you're 12 to 14 to 15 years old, it's ineligible to find employment legally. So many times, predators are able to pick up on these children and be able to force them into something in order for them to have a warm place to sleep, food, clothes on their back. They fall to these predators who offer them hope in ways that families and other support nets have failed them.
I think the last statistic I read was that 40% or so of the homeless or runaway youth on the street identify as LGB or T. So this problem must be of particular concern to this population of kids, right? I mean, talk about how a kid gets sort of drawn into this.
Many times, there's two kinds of pimps that are often discussed in pop culture. One is a gorilla pimp. It's someone who's commonly used to using violence in order to control another individual. While that still is pretty prevalent, especially in major metropolitans like Oakland or Richmond, Sacramento, what we often do find, especially with young kids, is actually that Romeo kind of pimp, that individual who teaches the child that, hey, I love you. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to give you that support that mom and dad didn't give you. I'm going to give you that support that your prior boyfriend couldn't give you. I have a nice car. Because you're 15, you've never been taken around in something this nice before. So they kind of build that relationship with that child. And then from there, manipulate the situation to saying, hey, I want to build that life for us together. But in order to do that, we're going to have more money. And I know that you're young and you can't get a job, so why don't we try this? See what's going to happen, and you're not going to get in trouble because you're a kid. So they'll put you in juvenile hall maybe for the night, but I'll come and pick you up. We'll tell them I'm your uncle, and I'll get you out of juvenile hall. Your mom and dad will never know, and we'll keep building that life.
So, I mean, these guys sound like predators. Are they out there looking for runaway kids on the street?
They are. A lot of cases are, in order to keep this business going, and it is an organized kind of crime, you have to have some sort of a supply. And if you don't have that supply, they're not going to make this money. Because ultimately what these traffickers are trying to do is get money, and that's really what it is these days. So what they're going to do is they're going to find as many teenagers or kids that they can manipulate to be able to get that money that they want. And ultimately the more they have, the more money they make.
So you mentioned that this is an organized criminal activity. How big is this network? I mean, is this connected with the Bay Area, or is this something that's localized in the North Bay?
It's all throughout the Bay Area. A lot of times there's a big circuit will happen. Many of these guys will run women, usually starting in the early evenings in the Oakland area, working on International Boulevard or working at a hotels in that same area of Oakland.
So let me just interrupt you for a second. So what you're saying is that kids from Santa Rosa who may be runaway are being picked up by these guys and transported to Oakland?
Correct.
And being prostituted out in Oakland?
Correct.
Wow.
So one of my first cases ever with this instance was a female who was 13 years old. She identified as a lesbian at the time. She was unhappy with her living environment, and so she decided to leave to go to another place where she felt she was going to be safer and better supported. So she left, went down to Marin County with a couple teenagers that she had met. And those teenagers introduced her to an adult male who ultimately said, I can provide you with a safe place to live for a while we help you get across country to be where you want to be. This male kept her in the hotel rooms that they were staying at in Marin County, and they hung out. They did drink. She admitted to some other uses of substances, but ultimately, when it came down to him encouraging her to do prostitution, she didn't want to at first. And then she felt kind of compelled because she's like, well, they're letting me stay here. They're taking care of me. It's cold out, so I have a place to stay. So I'll try. And she did. And ultimately, she realized that's not what she wanted. But now she no longer had a choice to get away. So ultimately, when we found her 4 weeks later, after doing the work that we did to find her, come to find out she was forced into prostitution 6 nights a week, up to 6 dates a night. And wow. Every dollar that she earned was forced to give back to him. So she was never able to get to where she wanted to. But yet she felt she couldn't go home because it wasn't a safe environment and she didn't want to stay with him. But the hopes and dreams that he had provided her to get to that next spot where she wanted to be were only going to be achieved if she stayed with him. And so that's why she would ultimately stay. When we found her, the terror in her eyes was so significant that that's what encouraged me to continue on. She was so worried that if he found out that she said anything, that he would kill her or her family or anything that was related to her. So ultimately, that's what ended up finding this passion to continue going down this path. And she was a Santa Rosa teenager that was forced from our county to work in San Rafael, Novato, Richmond, San Francisco, and Oakland, and some other East Bay cities for a 4-week period before we were able to actually find her.
And how, again, did you find her?
We were able to use some other techniques from phone calls and working with some other women that were working on the streets as well that had come forward to help with the case.
Okay, so she had been reported as a runaway by her parents?
Correct.
Okay, so there was some investigation going on that perhaps led to her.
Correct.
So I'd imagine some of these kids who run away or who are tossed out of the house by their parents because, for example, they come out, if the parent doesn't even file a case, a missing persons report, there may be nobody looking for them.
Correct. If there's no missing person or any kind of report to indicate that the child is missing, it sometimes falls upon the schools. And if the schools are working with school resource officers to talk about a truant child or what at the time they believe is truant because they're not showing up in school, those school resource officers are starting to pick up on these signs of human trafficking victims and starting to make those reports and dig into those cases
Wow.
to find out what's going on. Yeah. But if you don't have school resource officers and you have parents who just don't tend to care, then it's going to be a difficult time. We're going to be behind the ball by the time we get that investigation in our hands.
So how have these cases impacted you? I'm just curious. I mean, it must be very tough to run into meet a young girl like that who's got that kind of a story.
They're hard. This case in particular is a case that I feel like it's going to change my life. It's a case that I won't stop talking about for the next 30 years in law enforcement that I have going. And it's one of those things that it's hard to leave on your desk at work every night. It's hard knowing that a 13-year-old girl is somewhere and you know what's going on to her every single night and being comfortable sleeping in your own bed knowing that she's not comfortable right now. So it takes that passion to kind of keep going out even harder to look for these kids to get them to a safe place.
Now, you mentioned that you went to some specialized training when you began investigating these cases. I would imagine that this is an evolving area for law enforcement. Talk about what some of the things that we've learned about this problem.
A lot of the good things about law enforcement is the concept of human trafficking itself as a term is relatively new, but the practice of what's been going on has been out there for a long time. So as law enforcement, we're constantly trying to reevaluate the situations in our community and the problems that we're facing. So in this case in particular, the best thing that we've been doing right now is just getting on board and getting educated, getting sophisticated when it comes to the technologies that are involved. A lot of times, technology is the way that these kinds of crimes continue on because it's not like it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and even more, when these girls were walking up and down shady neighborhoods, and that's where they were picking up these dates. Now a lot of it's done through kick messaging or online sites like MyRedBook or Backpage.com and places where they're not having to walk anymore, but the Johns are actually coming to their hotel rooms or they're actually setting up apartments. So for us, a big part of what we've had to do is really change the way that we combat these issues. Before, it was just cite the girls or book them in jail and we're done with it. There's a statistic that came out that for every 100 arrests that are related to prostitution, 98 of those arrests were actually the women that were doing the work. 2 of those arrests were the males, and that was either the traffickers or the Johns that were purchasing the sex. What we've tried to do in Sonoma County in particular is change that model. Instead of going after the women, we treat them like they're victims. So when we do stings, we often have social services, we have Verity, the Rape Crisis and Trauma Center, as well as Crossing the Jordan representatives there to get these women services immediately, as opposed to treating them like suspects and booking them in jail. We find that now that we change this concept of how we look at the whole problem of human trafficking, and we focus on victim-oriented investigations, we then go after the traffickers and are actually making better cases because of this community-based working relationship that we have with nonprofits and law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. And I want to come back to those nonprofits because I understand that they're really making a big difference here. And certainly for those kids that are under 18, I mean, they truly are victims by circumstance.
But not just by circumstance either. I mean, no child under the age of 18 can consent to sex.
Right.
And so it's depressing to know in society that because a man puts $40 down on a nightstand and a 16-year-old takes it, then now we're perceiving that as her consenting to the act that's actually happening.
Right. Now, I know sort of historically, you know, prostitution has been seen as sort of a victimless crime. Getting back to the victim thing for a little bit. How successful have you been at prosecuting these cases? I mean, you've really got two types of offenders. You've got the John, who is engaging in sex with a minor,
mm-hmm.
and you've got the pimp. How are these cases being prosecuted, and what's your success been?
Right now, it's been relatively successful in a program and a way that we're doing it. It's really in its infancy. It's been amazing to work with the district attorney's office as of late, because working with particular DAs, we have what's called vertical prosecution. I work with the same DAs for these kinds of cases, so they're becoming familiar with how to go after these cases as well. And so we work as a team when we're investigating these things. So ultimately, we're finding a way to be successful because we end up working with nonprofits that make sure the girls are staying healthy, happy, and getting the services that they need, and being able to replace what that trafficker was providing them with. And because they have that support that they need to be able to get off on their own and be on their own, we're finding that they're finding that courage inside of them to come into court to testify. So we're getting more and more cases where these victims who normally and traditionally won't show up to court because they're too afraid or they're too controlled are actually finding that strength to come in, and we're actually receiving more convictions than I believe we probably have in the past. I'm not familiar with the DA statistics on human trafficking cases alone, but I would be hard-pressed to believe that we have not had more convictions in 2012 and will continue having 2013 than we have in years past because of the new model.
Yeah, and I would imagine that juries, you know, sitting in and listening to these gruesome details aren't very lenient on these guys. What's a typical sentence for a person who's trafficking young people?
That's the problem right now with our legislation, is currently if you're trafficking a minor, the max time that you can do for trafficking a minor is actually 8 years. It's only 5 years is the max for an adult. What we're finding is it's not substantial enough. In November of last year, the CASE Act, Prop 35, did pass with, I believe, over 80% of the vote, which would apply larger and more significant sentences to these kinds of cases. But a lot of that hasn't taken effect yet. We're finding that in November, there's a classified document that came out from the FBI in October of last year, and it stated that many gang and narcotics and arms dealers and those organized crime rings are actually starting to switching to running girls, whether they be adults or minors, because the punishment is significantly less. In our county, in the state of California in general, if you have a gang member who goes in and robs a grocery store with a gun, and he points that gun but never pulls the trigger, if the court can prove that he was a gang member, that he committed a robbery, and that he possessed the firearm, that mere possession of that firearm alone is a 10-year minimum enhancement. So for never even pulling the trigger of a gun and just having it, you now have a 10-year minimum sentence. But a 13-year-old girl who is forced to have sex with six different men a night, six nights a week, faces a max of 8 years.
That's crazy.
And that's if he's had a criminal history. If he hasn't had a criminal history, oftentimes the sentence can be less than that, and usually it's half time by the time they get to prison.
So you mentioned Proposition 35. How is that going to change the sentencing here in California?
It's significantly more substantial. I don't know the exact numbers, but they're looking somewhere between 15 to 20 years as opposed to the max of 8.
As well they should.
In those cases as well, they're required, if under the new CASE Act, to have to register as sex offenders once they're convicted, which currently under state law, they're not required.
Wow. So this is, it sounds like, certainly not just a problem that is centralized to the North Bay or the Bay Area, that indeed it's a national problem. Are you working with federal officials on this?
We do. So I work for a couple of different task forces. One of them is a work group. It's called the Loss of Innocence Work Group, and it's sponsored by the FBI. It's a nationwide work group, but it's broken down into different geographical locations. We work out of the one in the Bay Area. Some of our major cases that have gotten breaks in them are because of that collaborative environment. So many times I may have an idea of who a trafficker is or just have a picture because he's been in one of our hotels or we're looking for someone. I'll forward that information off to that work group, which is a combination of local law enforcement, probation, corrections, the FBI, and state or and city law enforcement. And within usually a couple of hours, we have that person identified. We also share resources with one another to be able to go after these people. So that collaborative is also a really big impact on a lot of our cases.
Great. You mentioned nonprofit organizations that are doing both educational work and victim support group. Talk about some of those organizations that you're working with.
One of the organizations that we work a lot with is Verity. It's the Sonoma County Rape, Crisis, and Trauma Center. What they do is provide victim services for all victims of those three areas. They've been great about coming out to be with our victims prior to interviews and after the interviews to make sure those victims are getting the support that they need. Crossing the Jordan Foundation is also a Santa Rosa-based organization that works with women that have been in this field for however long. They provide them with housing, they help them get in touch with medical services, food, clothing. They do a great job about rehabilitating a lot of these women that have been forced into this trade and being able to get them to their own abilities to take care of themselves and not needing these traffickers anymore to do that. We also work with some other great organizations like Soroptimus of Sonoma County, as well as the Junior Commission of Sonoma and Napa, who've really been a great organization about helping us raise funds when we put on conferences. Mm-hmm. Last October, we put together a conference for the Sonoma County Human Trafficking Task Force, and what that conference focused on was hotels. And we got together a group of 100 hotel owners and employees that talked about the issue of human trafficking, what it was, how to identify it, and what to do once it's been identified.
So explain the connection a little bit further with the hotel owners. Why is their role so critical?
A lot of the girls that we meet are working out of our local hotels. So almost every girl that comes up to Sonoma County and that's working is usually working out of a hotel room. They're usually not from here. Some do work out of apartments or houses, but primarily they're going in a circuit. And a lot of that circuit involves starting in Oakland in the evening, coming to Santa Rosa in the late evening, leaving and coming back to San Francisco at night. And they usually oftentimes stay in Sonoma County because they feel like the law enforcement isn't doing as much up here as those bigger cities are. So these hotel owners and managers and employees are seeing the vast majority of these victims coming in and out of their hotels, and they're seeing these Johns come in and out of their rooms on a regular basis throughout the night.
Hmm. And what kind of cooperation have you gotten from the hotel owners?
We've had some really great success with it. Before, we used to see calls for service come in and say, oh, they believe a hooker is staying in their hotel. Now we'll see calls for service coming into our dispatch center saying, hey, they believe a victim of human trafficking is in room 123. Or we're finding out that employees or managers of hotels are turning away people they believe are trafficking young women and calling law enforcement to let us know this is what's going on so we can try and contact those people and rescue those girls out of that situation.
So I'm curious, I mean, is it obvious to these hotel owners what's going on here? What are some of the signs that would tip off, let's say, a hotel clerk at a front desk that they're about to give a room to a trafficker?
I think a lot of times what it is you see the people that are coming in. And so it's usually one male, maybe another, but oftentimes one male with at least one female. The woman is usually dressed in some sort of scantily clad attire. And the males are usually doing the most of the talking. You'll also find that the male is arranging the reservation, but yet putting the reservation under the female's name because they don't want to be attached to that room. So they usually try and hide it that way. Or they'll not have an ID. They'll have something else or an out-of-state ID. It's really common that we told them what to do for these things or to ask questions, be customer service related in the sense that, oh, welcome to Sonoma County. What are you doing in our city? Anything you plan on seeing while you're up here? Have you been here before? Because when you ask Joe Schmo citizen, what brings you to Santa Rosa? They're going to tell you, I came here for the county fair or I came here to go to Safari West. Well, a lot of times these traffickers don't have an excuse. I'm here to go to the mall. I'm here to go see my friend. But their friend doesn't have a name. They don't know where they're from. Oftentimes these same traffickers will use the same hotels because the ones that don't question, they know they can keep going back to and not getting any heat from it. So when you check into these people into the rooms, running their names in your system to see how frequently they come there. Are they paying with cash? Prepaid debit cards are another really common way because they're a little more difficult to track. So a lot of times those are the warning signs to what to see. So we encourage them to ask those questions, put up signs that saying they don't advertise, they won't allow human trafficking in their hotels. A lot of things like that we're finding are deterring a lot of the men from going into these hotels.
So these guys are actually that brazen. They would actually walk up to the counter with some obviously underage girls?
Yes.
Crazy. Absolutely crazy. Well, it's good to hear that you're getting good cooperation from the businesses, though.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. You're doing some work in schools, and you mentioned earlier that schools play a pretty big role in helping to at least report kids that have been tossed out of the house. For example, are the LGBT young person who was tossed out of the house, whose parents may not report them as missing, what education are you giving the schools?
Right now, what we're trying to do is develop a program that's going to get into the schools that specifically talks about human trafficking. And it's going to be a two-step model. One is going to be for teachers and administrators about how to identify the signs of human trafficking, what to be looking for with your students, and what you can do once you've identified someone you believe to be in human trafficking. The second part of that is to be getting involved with actually the students. Nationwide, we're discovering that once students are involved in the issue, they are incredibly proactive. Many cases that we've found that of human trafficking or when the teenagers themselves, a friend of someone involved in that, actually steps up and says, hey, I think something's funny. My friend's been going on dates and her boyfriend's 21 years old. And all of a sudden they're wearing all these new clothes and these new expensive handbags and new shoes, but there's no reason for them to be having those things. So students are actually starting to lead the charge and being able to identify victims of human trafficking, which then gets brought into law enforcement. And then from there, we're able to investigate it. So the goal is to be able to get students more up to date about what it is and what these traffickers are looking for when they try and prey upon these younger individuals.
So for our Gay Straight Alliance members who are listening out there and their advisors who might be listening, give us a couple of things specifically to watch for in their peers that might suggest they've become involved in this problem.
Some of the things to look for are students that are being more withdrawn, who are focusing more on boyfriends and relationships, or even girlfriends in some cases, that are becoming a larger and larger fixation or attachment. Most times, and almost every time, the boyfriends or the girlfriends aren't going to those schools. They're usually over the age of 18. They're usually from other cities. And you'll find that they're coming back to school when they do come to school with free things. They'll have brand new purses. They'll have things that they can't afford because they're not working, but these boyfriends are buying them. They become more sexually active. You talk more about that. Looking when you see pictures of them, you'll start seeing more sexually suggestive photos in their phones or even online on Facebook and Twitter. Things like that are becoming more prevalent. Flashing money. Money is another really big indicator because at 14 years old, you're not going to be walking around with $300 in 20s. So those are really good indicators to start looking for. And just once that relationship starts to bond, that's usually where the problem begins.
And so what should someone do if they think that one of their friends is being lured into a life of prostitution, they start seeing some of these signs, whatever it may be, what should they do?
What I mostly recommend people to do is oftentimes talk to your teachers and your counselors because that's the first line of defense. Your teachers and your counselors are mandated reporters, so they're going to report that information. But state law allows them to be protected, so they can't actually disclose who gave the information up. So students can actually report this stuff anonymously and never have to actually bring it back up and be talked about again and not look like they're snitching on a friend or another schoolmate. Or if you feel more comfortable, you can always talk to law enforcement as well and get them involved early. Once again, they could be anonymous doing it that way.
So just call your local police department and lay out all the information that you believe is going on there. What about for parents? I imagine that I would guess that these guys are also preying on kids online. Are they trying to lure them in with, you know, Facebook kinds of things? Or
Facebook is a really big medium for being able to go after these young children. One of my most recent cases was an individual who was trafficking at least 5 women at one point, possibly more, and the majority of how he met them was through online social media. Parents need to be proactive in going through what's going on with their children, who they're communicating with, whether it's through social media or through text messages, and just be engaging with your children to figure out who they're having those conversations with. Ultimately, making sure that your Facebook profiles are locked and secured and private to be able to prevent these guys from trying to get a hold of the children.
So do you recommend parents go into their kids' Facebooks and look?
I would recommend ideally first talking to your child, so that way maybe it's more of a consensual, having an adult conversation even though they're still a teenager. That usually seems to get more response from the child as opposed to snooping, but you have to do what you have to do.
Wow, some pretty important information. Detective Chris Meehan, thanks so much for enlightening us about this really tragic crime problem. And thank you for the work that you're doing. Be safe out there.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a quick music break. This is local singer-songwriter Bobby Joe Valentine. And if you haven't had a chance to hear him yet, you can check him out in concert coming up this June at the Novato Hot Monk Tavern. You can learn more about Bobby Joe Valentine and this upcoming event on his website at bobbyjoevalentine.com. Here's Till the Clock Strikes Forever.
You take your freedom, I'll take the reins for a while. I know you don't need them, 'cause you still get your way when you smile. And in the dark, with the storms and the thunder, I won't tell a soul if my true love hides under. I won't tell a soul if my true love hides under me. Cause you are my wings, and you're made of the brightest of things, and you chase out the dark that the loneliness brings. Say you love me and you'll leave me never. Don't let me go till the clock strikes forever. Your freedom, and I'll take the reins for a while. I know you don't need them, 'cause you still get your way with me. And if and when Father Time makes us older, I won't tell a soul if you cry on my shoulder. No, I won't tell a soul if you cry on my shoulder. 'Cause you are my wings, and you're made of the brightest of things, and you chase out the dark that the loneliness brings. Say you love me and you'll leave me never. Don't let me go till the clock strikes forever. 'Cause you are my wings, and you're made of the brightest of things, and you chase out the dark that the loneliness brings. Say you love me and you'll leave me never. Don't let me go till the clock strikes forever. When Father Time makes us older, I won't tell a soul if you cry on my shoulder.
That was local singer and songwriter Bobby Joe Valentine with Till the Clock Strikes Forever from his newest album, Home. You're listening to Outbeat News in Depth on KRCB FM Windsor, Santa Rosa. And joining us now for this month's Outbeat Youth segment is Samantha Logan. She's a young transgender woman and activist who's been working as a blogger for the Matthew Shepard Foundation, publishing content on matthewsplace.com. Samantha, welcome to Outbeat Radio.
Thank you for letting me come on.
That's great to have you. Start up by telling us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up and where you went to school.
I kind of grew up in the middle of Cheyenne, Wyoming, very tight-knit community, very neutral as far as LGBT things goes. And I'm actually a transgendered woman. So when I was coming out, I was always kind of looking for online resources, and a community that was about an hour away from me ended up being what was really big in my life. So I'm kind of a communications major and advocate for LGBT organizations and local GSAs. I also run a few online YouTube channels, such as Trans Youth Channel, which is one of my main home stays for advocacy and things like that. My personal life in and of itself is actually pretty busy, so I spend a lot of my time kind of working on that advocacy, but I also do work and school, so I don't know. Sometimes I wish I could just slow down a little.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you're really busy. So tell us what it was like growing up in Cheyenne, and when did you discover your gender identity?
So growing up in Cheyenne was very interesting. It's a very neutral area. It's not very against LGBT, but it's also not very supportive of it. So I spent a lot of time in the dark about a lot of this. My transition and actually coming to light with it was a very interesting experience. As a child, before puberty, I didn't really identify with a gender. I was not male. I was not female. There were boys and girls, and then there was me. I didn't really internalize that at all. It was in about junior high when things kind of started hitting the fan. I spent a lot of time just kind of feeling wrong throughout my puberty because I was seeing people make this huge change. And I saw what was happening with the girls and I saw what was happening with the guys. And I just felt very wrong about it. I wanted the female puberty to happen to me. And that's kind of when my gender started taking a bit more of a large role in my life. So that's when my dysphoria kind of came up. And my dysphoria is not a lot like some transgender people's stories where you're a boy trapped in a girl's body or vice versa. Mine was more along the lines of an anonymous feeling. It was just that I felt wrong. I felt guilty about nothing in particular. It didn't really tell me what it was. I can say it was very torturous, although that's a little bit of a dramaticism there. But so I spent a large portion of my time just feeling bad and feeling wrong about myself, but I didn't know exactly why. So I spent a good 4 years throughout my high school trying to figure things out. And one of the things that kind of helped me to figure it out was when I was at home, I would cross-dress. I'd cross-dress in private, and that kind of started to grow. It wasn't a sexual thing at all. It would start at maybe being cross-dressed for about half an hour in ninth grade to there was a point where several friends asked me to go out to a movie, and I refused to go out to a movie because I wanted to be a girl in my own house for more than 8 hours when my dad was currently working overtime at the time. So that's kind of a huge turning point in telling me exactly what that dysphoria was. And that's kind of how I came to figure it out.
Wow. And so it sounds like you had good support at home. How did that go?
I didn't necessarily have any good support at home. I was doing that very secretively. My dad didn't know. My mom didn't know. None of my siblings knew. I would only do it when I was alone at the house. My mom is actually very supportive, and my dad is not very supportive at all. I was actually excommunicated from my dad's side of the family when I did come out.
Wow.
I actually kind of remember that day. And my coming out story is more along the lines of once I had figured out exactly who I was, I had very supportive friends. I went to a Unitarian Universalist church, which is a very open community. And several of my friends took me down to Fort Collins to kind of have my first real life experience. They didn't know that I was transgendered, but they were pushing me to cross dress and they thought that it would just be fun. It would loosen me up and I passed really well. So they took me down there. And at the end of 3 days wearing heels and being incredibly happy, I told my friends in the UU church. They were incredibly happy about it. They said, that's great. That's awesome. They were very welcoming. And then that's when I decided I needed to do this. So my coming out story was about 2 weeks all in all. And I came out first to friends on Facebook, posted pictures from that real life experience in Fort Collins. Mm-hmm. So all my friends knew. I didn't have any siblings that were on Facebook at the time. Then I decided to come out to my family. When I told my dad, he was the first family member to tell, I was about halfway down the stairs to my basement bedroom, and he was cooking at the stove right next to the stairs in the kitchen. He had a spatula in his hand, and I just turned about halfway through. I was feeling incredibly nervous, and he said, "Dad, I need to tell you something." And he just nonchalantly, "What do you want, Sam?" And then I just said, "I have girls' clothes downstairs. I want to be a girl, and I'm going to make this transition."
Wow.
Before I can even continue, he dropped the spatula, grabbed his coat, left, and our relationship has never been the same since. So that's kind of what happened with my dad, which is kind of a bummer. But the next day, which was a Saturday, I wasn't going to be deterred. I'd already come out to friends, and they were very supportive, and my dad was the only one who reacted badly. And I decided I was going to move forward and tell my mom. I was just going to do it a little bit better this time. Mm-hmm. I was going to kind of ease into it. So at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday, I walk into my mom's place, and she's like, "What do you need to talk about?" So I sit her down and I say, "Okay, so I have something to tell you." And I broke it to her easy. I said, "I have girls' clothes and I cross-dress at home privately." And she looks at me and she's like, "Okay." And then I say, "So I want to wear those clothes in public. I'm transgendered." And she says, "Okay." And then I say, I just go full-fledged here and just like, "I want to be a girl and I'm making the transition. And I want to be your daughter now." This time she looks at me and she's just like, "All right, that makes what I have to tell you a little bit easier." And then I just kind of looked at her and I'm like, "I'm sorry, wait, what?" And she looks at me, she smirks a little bit and says, "I have something to tell you too." And I'm like, "Okay." And then she just says straight out, she's bi. So my mom came out to me when I came out as transgender to her, supportive. But she actually one-upped my transition in a way, because right after that, she had a girl at the place who came out of the bedroom in her pajamas to make coffee right after she tells me that she's bi. So that's how I met my mom's partner at the time.
Wow. That's a pretty incredible story.
Yeah. I'm very happy to have my mom's side of the family with me, being very supportive. So
it sounds like, you know, despite the struggles with your dad, you've got a really good, strong support network between your friends and your church and clearly your mom's side of the family.
Yes, I definitely do. I'm very happy to have that support structure. Right.
Good for you. Good for you. So tell us about how you got involved with the Matthew Shepard Foundation.
Mm-hmm. So, as you know, I actually lived in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and I was young at the time when Matthew Shepard was all over the news and media. I was about 7 years old, and it didn't quite hit me at the time exactly what had happened to Matthew Shepard, because I'm this seven-year-old kid, and I hear this travesty, and I regard it as a travesty. But as I grew up, as I started feeling wrong, and as I started to discover what this dysphoria was, the Matthew Shepard case had actually quite an impact on me. Every time I thought about who I was and having a different gender, not being a boy, I would always think about how my dad reacted to that case. Because of that, it kind of scared me coming out about being transgendered. And I noticed when I came out that there was a community in Cheyenne that was a lot more supportive than I had originally thought. Mm-hmm. It's just that it wasn't out there completely. And because of that, I had noticed that this community really needed to be understood a little bit better. So I contacted Matthew Shepard Foundation as part of another group that I joined, being Across All Lines, my local GSA at my local college. And that's kind of the point where I looked at the Matthew Shepard Foundation, how it had affected me when it came out, and how the community in and of itself had supported me throughout all of that. Mm-hmm. So I kind of came to Matthew Shepard Foundation through other communities and through a realization that the Matthew Shepard case in and of itself had changed Cheyenne, changed Wyoming, and changed various areas around that. Mm-hmm. Colorado had been changed by it. And that's kind of where I wanted to help with mm-hmm. the Matthew Shepard Foundation. Mm-hmm. I kind of wanted to tell my story, living in the middle of Cheyenne and talking about the experiences and the culture change that happened after the Matthew Shepard case. Mm-hmm.
So you're a blogger for Matthew's Place, which is a youth-based website. Tell us about some of the things you've written about.
So I'm actually a video blogger. I do a lot of web-based stuff, webcams and video. One of the biggest things in my transition that I have found is about community. I feel that community being strong and interconnected and interweaved has a lot of profound effects on a personal, small group, public, and interactional level. So I feel it's really important when you come into a community that you know exactly what that community is doing for you. That's what my blog is about on Matthew's Place. It's about all of the parts of community, the anatomy of community that can help you change in all those different levels.
Mm-hmm. So what are you hoping to accomplish then, you know, sort of long-term for LGBT peers and youth who come to Matthew's Place and see your content?
So the wonders about the online, the internet, when it comes to the LGBT community, is that it's able to connect a lot larger crowds. And in addition to that, it covers various different target audiences. And one of those target audiences is those who are not out yet. That's a huge deal to be able to, not having come out as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgendered, not having to come out as that, but still being able to get all of those resources. So what I want to accomplish with my blog on Matthew's Place, I want to show people the strength of community. I want to be able to kind of take their hand and bring them from this online community where they're not out, but they are feeling more and more comfortable, into a physical community and an interactional community, both online and in their local areas. Mm-hmm. I want to kind of show them the importance of that interconnection and that they can rely on the community as well as helping to build it. So in the long term, I'm hoping that I can kind of bring people out of a shell and show them that there are people they can talk to. My ultimate goal is to make youth, in addition to others who are not out yet, feel more comfortable doing so and know that they have people who are willing to accept them.
Yeah, it's so important. And I think that's one of the real beauties of Matthew's Place is that for that young person who's, you know, up in the middle of the night, struggling with who they are, thinking that they're all by themselves, they can go and get some connection and see that, no, they're not by themselves and that there are many other people just like them out there.
Yeah, exactly.
So from your experience, if you were to talk with a group of college-bound LGBT people, give some advice about being out at college. Should you come out right away? Should you wait? What would you tell them?
Oh, that's definitely a really difficult topic there. When it comes to college and it comes to making friends and everything, college is a very different environment from high school. And I think a lot of the youth kind of find a culture shock in that. When I came out after high school and going into college, it was a bit of a culture shock for me because I shotgunned it out of the gate. I started living part-time a week into my freshman year at college. And I found myself being attacked on one side, nurtured on another side, and not exactly knowing who I was. A lot of college youth do face this going into college, and that's part of the college experience, learning exactly who you are. When it comes to being LGBT, however, and coming out and everything, I feel it's really important to look at your support networks that you already have before you come out, and looking at what support networks you can outreach to after you come out. Mm-hmm. Because when it comes to being excommunicated, losing friends, losing family, you want to have those people who will be there to say, I know how you feel. Come here. Let me help you out and reach their hands out and give you a shoulder to cry on.
Good.
As far as coming out in college, it's also really important that regardless of this transition, this huge coming out for any LGBT plus person, it's important to recognize that college in and of itself is more than discovering who you are. And being gay, being a lesbian, or being transgendered does not necessarily mean that you don't have a life outside of that. So don't obsess yourself with the coming out process, but look at other things. Don't drop too many other things that you plan to do.
Great. Great. So what's in store for your future?
I want to be a visual and auditory communications specialist for nonprofits and small businesses. I want to help nonprofits and small businesses grow in their physical communities and kind of learn the language in order to make themselves known, present their idea, and bring that to a stable community basis. That way they're able to grow and they're able to speak like many of the larger companies such as Walmart and things like that. I kind of want to help small businesses and nonprofits speak in a way that they can get their ideas across and keep them very stable at the same time. So my transition has been a huge help as far as that goes. And now I'm planning to go into PR specifically for these communities. So
great. Well, it sounds like you have such confidence now. I can hear that in your voice, and you're doing so much to really help others, which is fantastic as well.
Yeah, definitely. I've been very gifted with my life. I've had a very nice transition. It's been a little bit easier, and I don't think it would have been so easy without a community. So I've changed a lot, and I can thank the community and Matthew's Place for that. So.
Good for you. Well, thanks for all that you're doing for all the young people out there and all the great content that you're contributing to Matthew's Place.
Definitely. Thank you.
We've been talking with Samantha Logan, who's a blogger for matthewsplace.com, where you can go to learn more about LGBT life as a young person and find a variety of resources there. Samantha, before we go, give us your YouTube channel one more time.
So I actually have two channels. My personal channel is Name is Sammy, all one word. NameIssammi. And then we also have a collaborative trans channel that's very supportive if you're looking to learn a little bit more about what it's like to be a trans youth. That is Trans Youth Channel, once again, all one word, on YouTube.
Fantastic. And if you missed those, we'll have those on our own website at outbeatnews.com. Just click on show notes at the top of the page. Samantha, thanks for joining us tonight.
Definitely. Thanks for letting me join.
And that brings us to the end of our hour. My thanks to our guest tonight, Detective Chris Mehurin of the Santa Rosa Police Department, and Samantha Logan from matthewsplace.com. I'll be back next month on the fourth Sunday of May with Jay Foxworthy and his son Daniel. You may know him as the local Santa Rosa boy who wrote a letter to the Supreme Court advocating for his two dads and asking the court to overturn Proposition 8. And be sure to check our website for the latest information about this year's Pride celebrations happening here in Sonoma County, Napa, and San Francisco this coming June. Tune in next Sunday night to Outbeat Radio for Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Grayer. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a great week. Thanks so much for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia, exclusively for KRCB Radio. You can listen to our shows on demand, on iTunes, and on our website at outbeatnews.com. And be sure to follow us all week long on our Facebook page and Twitter feed for the latest LGBT news from here in the North Bay and beyond. We'll be right back. You're listening to KRCB FM Windsor, Santa Rosa. News, arts, and ideas where you are. On the air and online at 91.1 and 90.9 FM.